From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point. Gun policies are changing, not in the halls of Congress, but in the aisles of Walmart, Dick's Sporting Goods, Kroger, L.L. Bean. These are major retailers no longer selling guns to anyone under 21. An airline ending discounts for NRA members. Investors dumping shares of firearm companies, putting their money where their mouths and their outrage lie. They're earning praise from socially conscious consumers, but also backlash from those who want businesses to stay out of politics. This hour on Point, measuring the real impact of economic pressure on the gun industry. You can join us on air or online. What do you think of retailers making changes to how and who they sell their guns to? Are you now more likely to shop or stay away from stores that won't sell guns, for example, to anyone under 21? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. And joining me now from New York is Vanessa Furman. She's a Wall Street Journal reporter who covers corporate management and executive leadership, and she's been following the story. You can find a link to her piece headlined, CEOs Take Sides on Gun Control at Their Own Risk. That link is at our website, onpointradio.org. Vanessa, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Meghna.
So first of all, I mean, I guess, can you just bring us up to speed for a minute? I kind of quickly went through a list of some of the businesses that have made changes, but where are we now in terms of this economic pressure on guns?
Yeah, well, we've just seen over the last week and a half a really unprecedented wave of companies taking action on this issue. I think it's, I mean, companies in general and their business leaders have been shy about wading into debates on such divisive issues, and in this issue in particular. And over the last, yes, over the last 10 days, in response to a lot of social media pressure and calls for action from students at Parkland High School in Florida and elsewhere, they've taken action. You've seen retailers, as you just said, raise the age for buying guns, nixing the sales of AR-15s, and then on the other side of the aisle, we've seen companies stop discount programs for NRA members. So a lot of these are very symbolic moves, mm-hmm. but they are signs that companies feel like they have to take a stand.
Yeah. Well, so let's just actually play a piece of tape here from the CEO of one of those companies. This is Ed Stack, chairman and CEO of Dick's Sporting Goods. He told ABC's Good Morning America last week that the company had decided to end sales of semi-automatic rifles, or some of them, and ban the sale of guns to people younger than 21. And, of course, this was inspired by the Valentine's Day massacre and shooting at Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School in Florida. So here's Ed Stack.
Based on what's happened and looking at those kids and those parents, it moved us all unimaginably. And to think about the loss and the grief that those kids and those parents had, we said we need to do something, and we're taking these guns out of all of our stores permanently.
Now, Vanessa, Dick's actually did something similar after the Sandy Hook shooting, and they curbed sales on certain weapons for a while, but then several months later opened their sort of field and stream part of their business and started selling the same rifles all over again. So what's the sticking power of these moves this time around?
Right. I do think it is largely symbolic, but it's an important gesture. Dick's, as they said in their statement, after the Parkland shooting, they looked through their own records to see whether they had sold guns to the shooter, and they had sold one in November to the shooter, although it wasn't the type of gun or the gun that was actually used in the shooting. But the CEO was very explicit about this. He said, we could have been part of this story, and we don't want to be a part of this story. And so I think that was a large part of why they decided to do what they did. And I think he also was remarkable in that he went a step further and he called on the government to take action. Most of these companies in the actions they've taken over the last week have been pretty terse, pretty short about why they were doing it. I think it's a sign that they were responding to pressure more than anything, than wanting to be a really active part of the debate. Most of them put out statements simply on Twitter and didn't really expand on why they were doing it. But he went further and said, you know, we want to be part of the change. We want to take action here, and we want government to do something as well.
Yeah, so about that notion of companies acting within their spheres of influence to be part of the change, as you said. I mean, we've got a listener here who commented on our website. The listener goes by Jay Assange on the website. But the comment is, Dick's and Walmart are not big retailers for AR-15s. This is nothing but a PR stunt. Local gun shops and online retailers sell millions of AR-15 pattern rifles every year. So I guess the listener's wondering, how much of a change can this affect?
Right. I think in terms of gun sales themselves, probably not that much. The vast majority of guns of all kinds are sold tens of thousands of gun shops, pawn shops, other outlets, most of them privately owned. I think the statistic that's commonly cited for gun sales at these big box stores is something like 6%. So it's really not a huge impact, but it is interesting in that it sends a huge signal to certainly the rest of the retail world. It sends a huge signal to government, and it's possible. I mean, what's happening here is very similar to the playbook that we saw with same-sex marriage. We didn't see action or even much in the terms of statements, positions from politicians on either side of the political aisle for many years. And long before that, we saw companies adopting policies, extending healthcare benefits to spouses in same-sex marriages.
Right. Vanessa, can I just jump in here? Because I want to ask you, you pointed this out in your reporting. I think it's a really interesting comparison. Because I wonder, though, on the one hand, if in the whole evolution of same-sex marriage in this country, you were talking about companies who are sort of acting in the affirmative, right? They were offering products to same-sex couples. This is a case, though, where we're seeing companies acting in the negative, right? They're withdrawing sales from certain potential customers. Is there actually greater risk in that?
Possibly. Possibly in that the population or the consumer base that is going to be potentially offended by this is a highly mobilized one. I can tell you just from the stories I've written over the last week, I've gotten so many emails from readers, and overwhelmingly they are from people who are gun owners, they are NRA members, and feel very passionately about this, and they talk about whether they will or not, they talk about boycotting these companies. So I think there is that risk.
The NRA itself has called these moves a shameful display of political and civic cowardice, and that these companies seem to have forgotten that using their business as political platforms isn't a particularly bright business strategy.
Right. I think, though, overall, companies are making a judgment call. They see that this is potentially a sea change in the gun debate, at least for now. I think they're looking at the long game as well. They see the data that show that millennials, younger consumers, very much want companies to be more politically and socially active. They want them to take stands on issues. More often than not, that the stands they want them to take are more in this direction, more in the liberal direction, so to speak. And I think that's what's driving a lot of this.
Really interesting point. I actually want to come back to that in a little bit. But Vanessa Fermans is a reporter for The Wall Street Journal. She covers corporate management and executive leadership. She's written about CEOs choosing sides on gun control at their own risk. We've got a link to her article at onpointradio.org. Vanessa, hang in there for just a minute, because I want to introduce Rommel Dionisio. He's Managing Director of Equity Research at Aegis Capital, where he focuses on the gun industry. Rommel, welcome to On Point.
Thank you very much, Magda.
So Vanessa and I have been discussing the retail side of things, right? But there's the investment side as well. How much action have we seen? How much pressure has been put on major investors to perhaps, take another look at their portfolio and see if they have firearms manufacturers in there?
Sure. Well, similar to what we saw just after the Newtown tragedy several years ago, we're definitely now seeing over these last several days, significant asset managers, some of the largest asset managers in the world, including BlackRock and State Street, several state pension funds, that have discussed either completely divesting all their holdings in firearms-related manufacturers or sellers, or at least confronting the management teams of these companies to discuss what their response is to gun safety going forward. So we've definitely seen some selling pressure on these stocks. There's been a significant downturn in the share prices of the publicly traded firearms-related stocks just in the last few days, and the bulk of that selling pressure has clearly come from the potential and possibly even actions in the last few days for significant sized asset managers to divest their holdings.
Okay, so just let me. So you're saying that the downturn in some of these stocks is because of the asset managers thinking about divesting, or it's because of the, at least for a while on, you know, in Washington, we were having discussions amongst Republicans about possible gun control measures.
Yeah, so we've already seen there are already some factual things that we know. For example, the state of Michigan divested all their firearms-related holdings in the last few days. As they've announced, there's been significant pressure in the states of New Jersey and Florida for their pension funds to also divest their holdings. And several large asset managers who are currently some of the biggest holders of firearm stocks today have already confronted management teams for these companies and have talked about creating new financial instruments that will not hold these firearm stocks in their portfolios. So there likely has been selling pressure that's come down already in the last few days from divestitures of these holdings already.
I mean, is this good investment strategy, though? Because this is the question that comes up any time any social movement wants investors to divest from something, you know, fossil fuels, et cetera. We have about 30 seconds here. Is it a good investment strategy?
Well, I think that what you're seeing, I mean, the pension funds obviously have a responsibility to the citizens of their state. So there's that political pressure. But for the asset managers, they might see outflows of assets that are placed with them, whether from individuals or other entities, institutional investors. So they could really see people take away assets from their funds themselves.
Rommel, stand by here for a second. This is Rommel Dionisio. He is Managing Director of Equity Research at Aegis Capital. We were also speaking to Vanessa Fermans of The Wall Street Journal. We're talking about an economic push on gun control. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.
This podcast and following message are sponsored by the new CNN original series, Pope, the Most Powerful Man in History, a dramatic new 6-part series narrated by Liam Neeson that links recent news events surrounding the Vatican to their unexpected historical origins in the Catholic Church. From the start of the papacy to struggles with corruption to the challenges faced by wartime popes, go inside the Vatican to explore the roles of popes throughout history and how they spread Catholicism around the world. Pope airs Sundays at 10 p.m. Eastern on CNN.
Hey there, I'm Joshua Johnson, the host of 1A, a show where people gather to speak freely. You might learn something new, hear things that challenge you, and on Friday, we review the week's top stories. You'll find the 1A podcast on the NPR One app or wherever you listen to podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking about corporate activism and the economics of the debate over gun control. Joining me today is Vanessa Fermans. She's a reporter for The Wall Street Journal. She's been covering this story from the retail side of things. I'm also joined by Rommel Dionisio, Managing Director of Equity Research at Aegis Capital, where he focuses on the gun industry. And Rommel, I just want to sort of lob a quick comment that we got on Twitter to you and see what you think. Because listener Dale Ball tweeted, "This is more than symbolic. Looks like Dale sent L.L. Bean and Dick's emails to his spam folder, and he's pulling his 401k from any investor against the NRA. So is there potential for a backlash in the investment world here?"
Yeah, absolutely. I think you've already really begun to see that just over the last few days, similar to what we saw several years ago after the Newtown tragedy, where significant state pension funds and institutional investors take a close look at their portfolio and in some cases completely divest their portfolios of holdings in financial and firearms manufacturers or sellers. And that is certainly prompted by the potential for losing assets. A lot of these asset managers are paid on the amount of assets that they control. And if they, worry about individuals such as Dale pulling their 401ks, pulling their investments from that asset manager because it's known that they have holdings in firearms-related entities, then that's certainly of concern to them. And you're seeing that backlash
Well, how
really
many,
have an impact.
How many Dale Balls of the world of the nation would it take to get BlackRock's attention, though? I mean, they are enormous.
Yeah, it's the largest asset manager in the world, and they've already taken action. Just a couple of days after the Parkland tragedy, they announced that they were going to speak with the management teams of American Outdoor Brands and Sturm Ruger, two of the biggest publicly traded companies in the space, in the firearms space. As it turns out, BlackRock is one of the two largest shareholders of both stocks. And so they've been in discussions with management teams. In fact, American Outdoor Brands' board of directors released a response yesterday to BlackRock's question. So they definitely are beginning to take actions, and they are not alone. State Street, a very prominent bank, is also in discussions with the management teams of these firearms-related companies. And I think you're going to see a lot more here over the next several days and weeks.
Vanessa Fermans, BlackRock actually leads me back to, you know, something that your reporting has been taking on in terms of the central challenge that CEOs face, right? Because Larry Fink, who's the chairman of BlackRock, has said in the past that he wants to hold companies accountable not only to deliver financial performance, but also show how they make a positive contribution to society. Now, it's the second half of that part, which is the difficult balance, right? Because, you know, there's different opinions on the positive value of various social movements at different times. So how are CEOs supposed to know where to land?
Yeah, it is very tricky. Most companies and most CEOs, when they talk about this, they try to draw a line between social causes and political causes. Even with this one, which is so politically divisive and polarizing, you know, they try to put it very much in terms of gun safety, violence in America, less about policy, with the exception of the Dick's Sporting Goods CEO. But I think in actuality, that's a line that is probably lost on consumers and even investors
right.
as well.
We've got some comments here on our website. Honest Debate 2 sent this comment that these companies do it at their own peril. And for what? We tell 18-year-olds they can go fight wars. How can we tell them they can't buy a gun? Now, on that point of the age changes in terms of retailers, Walmart and Dick's and the like, in terms of who they're going to sell firearms to. 21-year-old Nathan Kendrick is opposed to this, raising the age to buy weapons. He spoke with CBS's Mark Strassman in Charlotte, North Carolina.
You bought your first gun from Walmart at 18, but you have a problem with the fact that they wouldn't sell you that same gun today.
Yeah, that's kind of stupid. If I was 18 years old and I was still trying to purchase that gun, why wouldn't they sell it to me now when I bought it 2 years ago?
All right. Well, let's take a quick call here. Jason is calling from Baltimore, Maryland. You're on the air, Jason.
Hi, Magna.
Hi. What's your thought today?
So my whole thought process with the whole issue, and one, you know, we can take it at face value. It is a political statement that these big companies are making, but it's one in the right direction. You know, for too long, we have dodged the issue of responsible gun control. And, you know, you can have a 21-year-old kid, or I'm sorry, you can have an 18-year-old kid who can go out and purchase a gun, but he walks next door to a liquor store and he can't get a pack of beer. It's like, it doesn't make a lot of sense. Any dangerous substance we regulate and we let, you know, these kids go in and buy guns, it just doesn't make sense to me.
Yeah. Jason, thank you so much for your call. Vanessa and Rama, let me get your quick response to this, because I think Jason's hitting something that I'm not sure how we get around, which is if retailers, even in their limited spheres, are sort of de facto making policy that we can't make as a nation or even, you know, as various states, ultimately, how effective is that, especially if so much of it is haphazard and just may not actually make sense to a lot of people?
Sure. It's, when we talk about the ages of 18 and 21 and what you can and can't do, I think there are contradictions all over the place. I do agree that it's unlikely that this will stop the sale or somehow curb the sale of guns. Even in that age group, there are literally tens of thousands of outlets and gun shows where people can of that age can still buy guns. And, you know, as we've seen before, if past this prologue, when companies or when there is some sort of policy movement to curb gun control, or even the idea, you know, certainly during the whole Obama administration, we saw gun sales surge because of the fear that the Obama administration would actually be able to do something on the gun front. It usually ends up boosting gun sales. So we could very well see this in this case
right.
as well.
So, Rommel, before I go to you on this point of does it make sense, last week, Warren Buffett, no less than Warren Buffett, told CNBC that his company, that Berkshire Hathaway, doesn't directly invest in any gun manufacturers, but there's no rule that it wouldn't. And he also said that he actually wouldn't want to impose his own political views on a company's investment decisions. And we should note that he's a member of the advisory board for Every Town for Gun Safety, a group that advocates for gun control. So here's what Warren Buffett told CNBC.
I think you should be pretty careful before the company takes in a big political opinion and something the society has decided that they say, well, we're going to have a different view. I also think people individually should very much express their views. I mean, I think what the kids are doing there is very admirable, but I don't think that Berkshire should say we're not going to do business with people that own guns. I think it'd be ridiculous.
Rommel, how do you read that?
Well, I think we need to delineate between, you know, corporations that are doing something from a social standpoint and asset managers that are actually doing something in their self-interest. Keep in mind the asset managers that we've discussed, like BlackRock, like State Street. These are privately held companies as opposed to public pension funds. They're compensated in two ways. One is from the performance of their portfolios. So naturally, they want to pick the best stocks or the best securities that will perform the best that they feel will perform the best. But they're also compensated by the amount of assets that they manage. And so if they are doing something that they feel, you know, there are people out there that will withdraw their 401ks or their assets in those asset managers because of the holdings that they hold, well, then there is a financial incentive to divest themselves of those holdings. Now, I don't want to make a judgment call on Larry Fink or the CEO of State Street and say what their motivation is for making the statements that they're making. But if they are, you know, it is something to think about. It is partly in their own self-interest that they are potentially divesting some of the holdings in these firearm stocks because of the fear that certain individuals or institutional investors that invest in their funds will withdraw those assets if they don't do that.
What an interesting and surprising overlapping portion of the Venn diagram of American attitudes and business interests when it comes to the question of guns. I want to get a quick call in here, and then we've got another very great guest that I want to bring into the conversation. But let's go to Sheila, who's calling from Newton, Massachusetts. You're on the air, Sheila.
Hi, Magna. I'd like to suggest another way that private individuals can use their money and put their money where their mouths are. You know, these kids in Parkland are, as one of your guests said, or as Warren Buffett said, admirable. But I don't think they're going to move the needle with the U.S. Congress in passing any new gun legislation. It hasn't happened before, and I don't think it's going to happen this time. On the other hand, as far as state legislation goes, there are ways. I know that David Hogg, one of the survivors in Parkland, suggested a boycott of Florida and instead suggested that people take their spring breaks in Puerto Rico in order to push the Florida legislature to pass better gun laws.
Huh.
I read an open letter by a bunch of doctors, oncologists actually, signed by dozens of doctors saying that they promise not to schedule their conferences in states that have bad gun laws. And I know that there's a petition to the NFL that they cancel the Super Bowl in Georgia and the one that's scheduled in Florida for the next two Super Bowls unless those states do better with their gun legislation. And that is actually a parallel with the LGBT community where activists got the NFL to threaten to take their business out of Arizona and Virginia because of anti-gay legislation. So I think that those are ways in which adults can support the kids by putting their money where their mouth is.
Yeah, I got you, Sheila. Thank you so much for your call. Let's bring in another voice here. Adam Winkler is professor of law at the University of California, Los Angeles. He's also author of We the Corporations, How American Businesses Won Their Civil Rights, and also of Gunfight, the Battle Over the Right to Bear Arms in America. Adam Winkler, welcome to On Point.
Thanks so much for having me.
So you've heard a lot of discussion here so far about the investment sector, about retail with Vanessa and Rommel, and the diversity of opinions on about how effective this sort of economic activism might be in the gun control debate in the United States. I mean, what's your take? Is it significant this time around that we seem to be seeing lots of direct pressure being put on businesses?
I think it is significant. It's significant, number one, because people are so frustrated with the inability to get good and effective gun control laws passed through Congress that people are looking to other avenues for reform. For a while, gun violence prevention efforts have been focused at the state level. But now there's really an effort to try to use the private marketplace and big business to pressure the NRA and lawmakers as well. I also think it's significant because I think a lot of these companies are taking these actions because they feel consumers want it. And if consumers are making these demands upon companies today, there's a good chance they'll make those same demands on elected officials come November.
Okay. Well, let me just play another bit of tape here then. This is from Georgia. This is last week when Georgia's lieutenant governor and gubernatorial candidate Casey Cagle tweeted that he would end any tax legislation that benefits Atlanta-based Delta, unless Delta reverses its decision to end some discounted travel programs for members of the NRA. So here's Casey Cagle speaking to Fox News.
Had they have treated everyone in terms of their discounts fairly, we wouldn't be in this situation. But instead, they chose to single out the NRA and their membership, law-abiding gun owners.
Right.
And I don't think that's right. And so I have to govern based on principles, and obviously, they have a choice to make.
Adam Winkler, your response to that, because that is the flip side to the, you know, corporations making decisions based on certain principles. There are millions of Americans who hold the opposite set of principles.
Well, that's right. And one of the real interesting questions is whether these moves will be long-lasting and effective, because what we've seen in the past is when gun makers or big companies have pushed back against the NRA, gun owners have really risen up. You know, one of the things about today's gun owners is that they're a really huge political force because they're really well mobilized, they're really well connected, and really active politically. And I'd be surprised if we don't see a real pushback from the gun-owning community against these retailers and others who might be trying to challenge the NRA.
Vanessa Fermans, jump back in here, because you were talking a little bit earlier about the pushback that retailers might see. I mean, is Adam on to something there?
I think so, but I think we should have a note of caution about the spending decisions of consumers. Consumers are, on the whole, still highly habitual spenders. We don't tend to actually make breaks with what we say we're going to do. I think the real risk probably is in the reputational hits some companies might take, and simply the pressure on social media. But consumers don't tend to actually change the way they spend money. And I think that is partly the reason why we've seen companies decide to make the changes they have, because they've decided it's going to be, in the long run, more beneficial to cease these partnerships as opposed to continue them.
Rommel Dionisio, I'm going to get your name right there, Rommel. Can we see investor behavior to be as fickle as Vanessa was describing consumer behavior might be?
I think there's an element of truth to that. Historically, after the Newtown tragedy several years ago, we saw significant actions by large asset managers, the state of California's pension funds, the state of New York's pension funds, to completely divest their holdings of firearms-related stocks and debt holders as well. And that didn't last very long, frankly. After several months, after about a year, other investors stepped in. The valuations of firearms companies began to rise back up. And so, you know, historically, there hasn't necessarily been a permanent hit or devaluation to the multiples of the stocks that are publicly traded. from investors pulling out of holdings in these names.
Mm. Well, we are talking about the economic push in the gun control debate in the United States today. I'm joined by Vanessa Fermans and Rommel Dionisio and Adam Winkler. We've got lots of comments here. Ray Russell on Facebook says, focus on the real issues, social media and video games. Kids today bully easily through social media without physical confrontation. It's not just a coincidence that the huge increase in school shootings have occurred with the proliferation of Facebook, Instagram, and others. That's the view of Ray Russell on our Facebook page. And I'm going to get to a bunch of callers after the break. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.
What's unique about the human experience, and what do we all have in common? I'm Guy Raz. Every week on TED Radio Hour, we go on a journey through the big ideas, emotions, and discoveries that fill all of us with wonder. Find it on NPR One or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking about economic activism and the national debate over gun control. I'm joined this hour by Vanessa Fermans of The Wall Street Journal, by Rommel Dionisio, Managing Director of Equity Research at Aegis Capital, and by Adam Winkler, Professor of Law at the University of California, Los Angeles. On our website, onpointradio.org, we've got lots of comments. One of them comes from Michigan JF, who says, these companies are making responsible choices about what types of arms to sell. They are not eliminating guns wholesale. They are only eliminating those arms which logically do not make sense in a civilized society. Let's get another view from John, who's calling from Detroit, Michigan. You're on the air, John.
Thanks, Meghna. So I want to open a can of worms. So I'm not sure who, I just heard it on your program today that somebody said that businesses shouldn't get involved in politics. Well, that would be the best thing for the American public. Let's face it, Washington is controlled by corporations, and businesses shouldn't be involved in politics. But I'm just curious as to who said that.
John, thank you. Actually, thank you so much for your call. There's a lot of people who are wondering something similar because listener Cecile tweeted us, now they want businesses to stay out of politics. Maybe they should have thought of that before Citizens United. Adam Winkler, let me give that one to you. That's in your wheelhouse. What's your response?
Well, that's right. I mean, we are seeing businesses play an important role, both in, as we've talked about today, the gay rights debate and the transgender bathroom bills, and now the gun debate as well. But there is a real danger in recognizing the corporate influence on these public policy issues, because while today they may be pursuing progressive ends, tomorrow they'll be really focused on maximizing their profit. And I think at the end of the day, these businesses take these positions because they think it's good for their brand or they think it's good for sales to customers, and not because it's just the right thing to do. And in fact, we've designed corporations so that they generally don't pursue the right thing, but pursue profit.
Yeah. Vanessa Fermans, I mean, you look closely at corporate management and executive leadership. This idea that making these moves is good for their brand, how potent of a force is that in decision making today?
I do very much agree with that. I think, you know, and that's part of what probably went into the calculus for these retailers like Dick's and Walmart's. You know, Dick's is and Walmart are they have a small consumer base that is the typical hunting customer, the gun buyer, but the much, much bigger part of their consumer base is the suburban mom, the consumer they're trying to compete against Amazon for, in a whole range of other types of products and services. And we already see that companies some companies have benefited from taking on a bit of a, they would not perhaps admit it, but a bit of a political aura. You know, I think people identify companies like Starbucks and Patagonia with perhaps more progressive issues. They might identify a company like Chick-fil-A with more conservative mm-hmm. issues. So mm-hmm. Companies have used this to their advantage.
But,
certainly.
You know, I mean, even within corporations or people who once had close ties to them, there's a diversity of opinions on this. I mean, let's listen to some tape. This is Bill Simon, former CEO of Walmart's U.S. operations. He told CNBC last month that retailers not selling guns anymore would not solve gun violence and would probably make the situation even more dangerous. Here he is.
If these things are legal, and they are today, you want responsible retailers selling them so they can be documented and videotaped and tracked, and responsible retailers help the police in the event that something happens.
Vanessa, your thoughts on that?
Yes, I think that's very likely. I mean, as we've been talking about, there are so many outlets for buying and selling guns. The more that we see big box stores perhaps close out certain segments of those sales, we'll see those consumers that want to buy those go to other outlets.
Yeah. Well, sorry, I didn't mean to jump in on you there, but there are a lot of callers who want to join us, Vanessa. So hang in there for a second. David is calling from Hartsville, Tennessee. You're on the air, David.
Yes, thank you. I appreciate you taking my call. The problem is a gun, folks. We can work around the edges, but it is a federal law that you can't hunt migratory birds with more than three shells, and you have to manually reload. And we are selling these human-killing guns with unlimited capacities, including bump stocks, that are meant to kill, and we have to go after it. Private ownership is good. Let them store it at the gun range if they need to shoot, just for the hell of it. But hunters, and I am one of them, resist these guns being on the market, being available to kill people. Yeah. It should be stopped.
David, thank you so very much for your call. Adam Winkler, respond to that.
Well, I think that reflects a lot of views, a lot of gun owners out there. You know, we often think that the NRA represents America's gun owners, but it's much more complicated than that. The NRA has a very extreme view. They're out of touch with many, many gun owners who want to see more done to reduce gun violence. For many gun owners, they recognize that it's in their self-interest to have good and effective gun control laws, because if we have those good laws, if we can bring down these mass shootings, bring down the daily death toll from gun violence, then there's less pressure to adopt laws that restrict access to firearms. So I think that view is widely shared among gun owners.
Rommel Dionisio, let me bring you back in here, because we do have examples, past examples, that we can learn from in terms of what happened when the investment world made some decisions around guns and gun manufacturers, right? Because Cerberus Capital Management did allow its investors to sell stakes in Remington after the Sandy Hook school shooting. What happened then, and does it bear some lessons for investors in the finance world this time around?
Absolutely. The day after, I think 2 days after the Newtown tragedy, which you referred to, Cerberus Capital, which owned Remington, it was a private equity firm owning Remington, announced that they would be divesting their ownership in Remington. Now, there's a little bit of a backdrop to that, however, and I don't mean to sound too cynical, but it wasn't purely out of a social interest. Cerberus Capital's largest investors were actually state pension funds, like the state of California, and it was those pension funds that threatened to pull all their assets away from private equity firms and hedge funds and money managers like Cerberus Capital if they did not divest their holdings. So that clearly played some motivation in their decision to divest their holdings in Cerberus.
And Remington since is filing bankruptcy.
Correct. Just about a month ago, they filed for bankruptcy. The firearms market has been in a pretty prolonged downturn since the election of President Trump in late 2016. And Remington has a significantly high exposure to modern sporting rifles, or assault rifles as otherwise known. And they just could not survive this recent downturn in the firearms market.
Hmm. Well, we got a lot of callers, so let's get to a couple more of them. Carlo is calling from Lake Placid, New York. You're on the air, Carlo.
Hi. This kind of goes to the earlier statement. I just find that there seems to be no common sense approach. I mean, the vast majority of people want gun reform, and the vast majority of gun owners are never going to be a threat or a concern, you know, for breaking the laws or anything. And why not approach something that, I don't care what the background check is or how extreme it is, but don't take gun owners' rights away. And it seems to me that would be a great starting point to get something done instead of these extremes where it's also infringing on owners' rights. Hmm. And it seems like it's just a nowhere fight.
Carlo, thank you so much for your call. Adam Winkler, respond to that, because I hear a couple things in what Carlo's saying, that on the one hand, he doesn't feel that there's middle ground on such a divisive issue in the United States. But then again, perhaps there is legally. I mean, what do you make of that?
Well, there's clearly a legal middle ground. The Supreme Court has said that there is a right to keep and bear arms in your home for personal protection. But the courts have upheld the vast majority of gun control laws even after that decision. So I think there is a middle ground on guns. The difficulty is finding it and getting elected officials to promote it. Because part of the story is yes, there is widespread support for new efforts to restrict, to do something about gun violence, like universal background checks. But in a democracy, you need more than just 51% of the people. It's important that you measure the intensity of the voters, too. And what's happened in the past years is that even though widespread support for gun control exists, the more intense voters, the ones who are more active and more mobilized, are on the pro-gun side. Maybe what we're seeing since Parkland with the mobilization of all these students might change that calculus in the future.
Yeah. So there's one thing we haven't talked about is getting it back down to the economic activism that we're seeing right now, is that especially retailers who maybe choose to make changes in who and how they sell firearms, don't they risk running afoul of the law? I mean, in several states, you can legally buy a weapon when you're 18. In Oregon right now, there's someone who's suing Dick's because they're not going to sell him a weapon because he's not 21, but the legal age in the state is 18, Adam.
That's right. I think that Dick's and Walmart and others will have some difficulty in some states. About a third of the states prohibit age discrimination against people over the age of 18 by retailers. And so long as the product is legal, then those states have taken it out of the retailer's hands to pick and choose who their customers are going to be on the basis of age. But it's only in some states. It's not in every state. It's only about a third of the states have those laws. But look, even though preventing gun violence is really important, it's not an excuse to avoid or to allow businesses to refuse to apply the civil rights laws that guarantee equal access. We shouldn't have retailers denying people wedding cakes because they're a same-sex couple, and we shouldn't have retailers disobey laws requiring or prohibiting age discrimination just because we want to get rid of gun violence.
Vanessa Fermans, what's your thought about that?
I think we will see a flurry of legal action in some states, and it will probably chart some new ground in what retailers are going to be able to do or not do.
Right. Well, let's take another call here. Fred is calling from Idaho Falls, Idaho. Fred, you're on the air.
What I wanted to speak about has pretty much been covered by the other callers. The one point by a previous caller about using military-style guns to go out and hunt deer doesn't make much sense to me. And I wanted to say that I have heard very little from any of the discussion, protest, debate about simply barring the future sale and the future sale to citizenry of these military weapon style guns. Mm. They were designed, I believe, for military and police, certainly for police, to protect the citizenry. But I cannot understand why nothing's been said about removing them from the citizen.
Well, Fred, thank you so much for your call. Adam Winkler, we did have, for a period of several years, a federal level ban on certain styles of semi-automatic weapons. I mean, maybe Fred, the point Fred's trying to make is that doesn't seem to be anywhere near to being on the table this time around.
I think that he's right in the sense that while there have been people that have been talking about banning AR-15s and these military-style rifles since the Parkland shooting, the truth is the gun violence prevention organizations have long ago decided that banning assault weapons was not where they wanted to devote their resources, largely because while these firearms have become popular among mass shooters, They're actually, they account for a very, very tiny fraction of overall gun deaths every year, even with these mass shootings. There's less than 300 of the 30,000 gun deaths every year that are attributable to rifles of any sort, assault rifles or non-assault rifles. So this is not a major priority for the gun violence prevention movement. And it's hard to believe that the Parkland shooter, if he didn't have access to a military-style assault rifle, would have just stayed at home rather than committed his killing with a handgun. So as a result, I think for many in the gun violence prevention movement, the focus on assault weapons is a little bit of a distraction because it won't have a big public policy impact, even if we were to ban these weapons.
Yeah. So we've just got about 2.5 minutes to go here, and I wanted to return to something that Vanessa said earlier, and that's about the generational change we're seeing here in terms of activism and leadership, grassroots leadership on this issue of economic activism and gun control. Because Vanessa was saying earlier that just that millennials by far believe that corporations and CEOs need to be socially aware and socially active as a part of their businesses. And how much do you think that's going to matter going forward vis-a-vis gun control in America? And Rommel, let me start with you. I mean, is that something that's evident in the investment world? We've just got a couple of minutes here, so try to keep it tight if you
sure.
could.
Sure. Absolutely. It absolutely is. It's a growing impetus that people vote with their feet, that they have the ability to take away their assets from asset managers from one mutual fund to another. And if one mutual fund is investing in firearm stocks and an individual does not want that, they can just as easily take that away and put it somewhere else. So that very much is a motivation for some of these large asset managers doing what they're doing right now in terms of looking to divest their holdings.
And Vanessa, I mean, you're the one who brought this up, that millennials are a larger cohort than Gen X by far, and also, I believe, also than boomers as well.
Yes, yes. I mean, in terms of believing that you should, that a company should be taking a stand, that CEOs should be speaking out on social and political issues is much more prevalent of a belief among millennials than they are by Gen Xers and baby boomers by far. And it's not just consumers, it's employees. And I think that's where companies really are seeing a lot of pressure as well. We saw this last year with issues like the immigration ban, the Charlottesville protests that turned violent. A lot of that pressure for companies to speak out came from their millennial employees.
Yeah. And Adam Winkler, just got about 30 seconds here. Your last thought.
Well, I think it's going to be really interesting to see whether this mobilization lasts. You know, as we said earlier, these kinds of pressures on companies should turn into pressure on elected officials. And if so, then it might break the logjam on guns.
Right. That's the big if, though, isn't it? Well, Adam Winkler, professor of law at the University of California, Los Angeles, and author of Gunfight, The Battle Over the Right to Bear Arms in America. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
And Rommel Dionisio, Managing Director of Equity Research at Aegis Capital, where he focuses on the gun industry. Thank you as well.
Thank you.
And Vanessa Fermans, reporter for The Wall Street Journal. Real pleasure to have you on. Thank you, Vanessa.
It's great to be here. Thank you.
Well, that's it for today. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Thank you so much for listening. This is On Point.